Can we grab a seat, everybody? Some good conversation. Hopefully you picked up a tip or two. How funny. Well, welcome. Again, glad to have you here. No kid stuff today, but you know, that's right, I was supposed to do that during the break. There is some kid activity type things. So, like, Teresa has strep throat, unfortunately. So she came in today, which she shouldn't have done, but she did. She came in and got this stuff ready. And so, kids, we would invite you certainly to use it. That even includes Evan. Mm-hmm. Coloring sheets. Oh, easy, Tiger. Easy, easy. Yeah, I know. It's just, I mean, wow. That was a strong move on your part. All right. So there you go. Enjoy. Color away. And then we're actually going to do something together at the end of our time this morning that will involve everybody and will involve some more crayons and things of that nature. First, if you would you head to Isaiah 58? And if you have a phone, might be helpful if you want to pull it up there, because then you can read it with me in the New Living Translation, the NLT. And you're going to probably want, well, you don't have to. You might want to read along, because we're going to read a fair portion of this chapter, almost all of it. Starting in verse 1, we'll go all the way down to verse 12. Isaiah 58. Yep. Thanks for asking. Isaiah 58. So the prophet, as all of the prophets do, they are talking to the people of Israel, and God is speaking through the prophet to the nation. And this is a really important chapter for Israel, and I think for us too. So let's start up in verse 1, and then we'll get down all the way to verse 12. Isaiah 58, here we go. Shout with the voice of a trumpet blast. Shout aloud, don't be timid. Tell my people Israel of their sins. All right, so we get a sense of where this is headed, right? This is a confrontational moment. Not unusual for the prophets to do this. They're confronting Israel, and they have a message from God. Tell my people Israel of their sins, yet they act so pious. They come to the temple every day and seem delighted to learn all about me. They act like a righteous nation that would never abandon the law of the laws of its God. They ask me to take action on their behalf, pretending they want to be near me. We have fasted before you, they say. Why aren't you impressed? We've been very hard on ourselves, and you don't even notice it. And then God says, I will tell you why. It's because you are fasting to please yourselves. Even while you fast, you keep oppressing your workers. What good is fasting when you keep on fighting and quarreling? This kind of fasting will never get you anywhere with me. You humble yourselves by going through the motions of penance, bowing your heads like reeds bending in the wind. You dress in burlap and cover yourselves with ashes. Is this what you call fasting? Do you really think this will please the Lord? No, this is the kind of fasting I want. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the burden of those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free and remove the chains that bind people. Share your food with the hungry and give shelter to the homeless. Give clothes to those who need them. And do not hide from relatives who need your help. Maybe the toughest line in the whole chapter. Then your salvation will come like the dawn, and your wounds will quickly heal. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. Yes, I am here, he will quickly reply. So remove the heavy yoke of oppression. Stop pointing your finger and spreading vicious rumors. Feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness around you will be as bright as noon. The Lord will guide you continually, giving you water when you are dry and restoring your strength. You will be like a well-watered garden, like an ever-flowing spring, and you will rebuild the deserted ruins of your cities. And then you will be known as a rebuilder of walls and a restorer of homes. This is a compelling, powerful vision of what should be. Because Israel has gotten things mixed up. They've come to think that being the people of God meant that they were supposed to be exemplary people when it came to their religious practice. So fasting, praying, offering sacrifices, if they did those things correctly and regularly enough, God would be pleased. It reminds me of like a dinner host preparing their home and being just obsessed with how the napkins are folded and how the silverware is laid out and how the flowers are arranged. Obsessed with those details to the point that they completely neglect their guests. Their guests arrive and they're so concerned about the napkins that they treat their guests rudely. You know, they're so uptight about the food being perfect that they lack generosity and kindness towards the people that have entered their home. I think this is something like what's happening in Israel. They're so obsessed with the details of religiosity that they neglect what really matters. And so God calls them back, gives them a vision of what the world should look like. And you may have noticed it has everything to do with people and place. Right? It's a vision that results in the poor being cared for, the worker being treated fairly, gossip ceasing, the hungry being fed. It's a vision about people, and it's a vision about place. This is verse 12, where we stopped reading. You will rebuild the deserted ruins of your cities, and then you will be known as a rebuilder of walls and a restorer of homes. Eugene Peterson in The Message translates that verse this way. You'll be known as those who can fix anything, restore old ruins, rebuild and renovate, make the community livable again. This is who we are to be. People who rebuild and renovate and restore, who make the community livable again. We are to be people who inhabit our spaces, who rediscover that God is present in our places, and who are, through our own lives, the presence of Christ to other people. That is who we are called to be. And over the last few weeks, we've been talking about how we might go about inhabiting our places, and we've been talking about things like the need to regain our sight, to see again that the world is full of God's beauty. God's renewal is already happening around us. We just have to have eyes to see it. That when we do that, when we regain our sight, we also can have our imaginations reignited for what's possible. If you never see the beauty, it's easy to become cynical and hopeless. But if we have eyes to see, then our imaginations wake up. And we also, as we talked about last week, are wise to remember our source of security. Our security doesn't arise from ourselves or our own abilities, but it arises from God's grace, as we were singing about this morning. So that's where we've been. Today, I want to invite us to think about the taste of place. And to do that, I'm going to dip into a book that I've been reading. I think I pointed it out a couple weeks ago, The Bees of Rainbow Falls. And it's written by a guy who's a pastor up in British Columbia, and he decides to take up the hobby of beekeeping, of all things. And this book is about his experience with beekeeping and what it's taught him about community, about God, and about our call to be rebuilders and renovators to make our communities livable again. So towards the tail end of the book, he talks about something that's really interesting about how honey from different parts of the world has different flavors. Did you know this? I didn't know this. Some of you are wiser than I am. You already knew. Honey has this thing called terroir. I think that's the right way to say it. It's a French origin word, terroir. Terroir, something like that. And wine has terroir. Honey has it because terroir is the taste of place. It is the way in which a bottle of wine from a certain region has a unique flavor profile, they tell me. I can't tell. You know, this is what they say. Honey is the same way. Honey is the same way. And so I thought, you know, what better thing to do today than to taste some honey? So let's do that together. Spoons and bears, don't do this, anyone. You especially. Just put it into, you know, a little bit on that spoon. Just let's taste some honey together. It may take a while for it to get around, but that's fine. And I want you to, as you taste it, I want you to kind of think, huh, I wonder, what about this honey, what about its taste is unique? What about its taste might tell us about where it comes from? And how might that differ from other sources of honey? Does anybody know where most of the honey that we buy at the grocery store comes from? Brennan, where does it come from? That's correct. Bees, yes. Do we know what's that? You would think, yes, you would think from sources of nectar, but that's our honey on the grocery store shelf, most of it doesn't come from nectar from flowers. What do you think, Salmon? Bee farms. So what happens at a bee farm? Do you know? Yeah. And do you know what the bees eat? Anybody know what they feed the bees on these bee farms? It's not flowers. It's not nectar.
Sugar water.
Sugar water, yeah. I mean, high fructose corn syrup. They dump barrels of it, and the bees feed on it. And then they go and they make the honey that we have. It's a very economical, industrial way to make honey. But sorry to say, that's the kind of honey that you're eating right now. And so what sort of taste that's unique does it have? I don't know. Probably nothing. It tastes like a barrel of corn syrup, perhaps. Brennan, yes, you have something else to say. Yes, that's true. That's very true. Thank you for that piece of information. So, sadly, you know, the honey that we're enjoying here together, it tastes great. I love it. Put it on my toast in the morning. It's a special treat. You know, it's good stuff. But it is not quite like the honey that you would experience if you were buying something that was just, you know, created naturally through the gathering of nectar. And again, where you are in the world makes a difference to how the honey tastes. So he writes about how he is in British Columbia, and up in the mountains of British Columbia, there's an apiary. This is what you call a collection of bees that are making honey, an apiary. And up there, it's a really high altitude. About the only thing that grows at that altitude are pine trees. So guess what flavor the honey has? A little bit of pine. A little bit of pine in it. Yeah. He traveled to Nairobi, Kenya. And their honey, because of the flowers and the nectar, it's actually really dark and strong tasting, more like a molasses than it is what, again, we would be used to eating. So Kenyan honey, very different. He writes about how he has some honey from Laos, which is right Pacific near the equator. And Laos, right on the bottle of honey that he says that he bought, it reads, "Taste the jungles of Laos in our honey." Now, I don't know what jungle tastes like, but they're advertising it, right? Like you're going to taste the place that this honey comes from. And then he kind of writes, gets a little philosophical. You know, I like this. I like where he goes next. He starts writing about the bees of Israel. It's probably a special meeting because we were there, you know, about a year ago. And how the bees in Israel travel across the border into Syria and gather nectar and then bring it back and make honey. And how the bees in Lebanon, which is the northern neighbor of Israel, travel down from Lebanon into Israel to the fruit tree groves, collect nectar, go back. how bees have no sense of border, you know, how they defy kind of these human boundaries. And he says when he had some of that honey, it was just like this really powerful, reflective moment for him. So he gets really fun and philosophical and existential. I like it, you know, but he gets you thinking about where's the honey coming from and what is the unique taste of that place. And then he writes this, and I'm just going to read it because he says it better than I could say it. He says, as I taste the world through jars of honey and reflect on the taste of my own neighborhood, I've begun to wonder, does my neighborhood have terroir? Do I have the imagination to see God's hand at work, shaping the unique qualities of beauty and hope, life and love in my own community and along my street? Does Rainbow Falls have a kind of flavor that makes it unique in all the world? He says, in many ways, my neighborhood is a mix of suburban homes with cars and trucks lining the streets. Families from different backgrounds come and go. And in some ways, anyone could pass through and never really reflect on what would make this neighborhood unique. But I'm starting to see that in the same way that an apple tree or catmint could subtly contribute to the flavor profile of my honey, there is some kind of beautiful potential built into my neighborhood. Individuals and families have before them a chance to change the taste of their place. We are called to be rebuilders and renovators, to make the community livable again. And one way to think about that is to ask yourself, what flavor do I bring to the place where I live? How might I influence the terroir of my neighborhood? And maybe you've never thought about it in this way, and maybe you're even a bit skeptical. Maybe like Preston, you would say, my neighborhood's just a normal neighborhood. There's nothing unique about where I live. I would challenge you to consider that a little more carefully. Every place has a unique flavor, if for no other reason that every place is filled with unique people who come from unique backgrounds and have unique perspectives. So what flavor does your place have? What's the terroir of your neighborhood? Well, we're going to take some time here this morning to reflect on that and to do it in what I hope is a fun sort of way. And you'll notice there's no communion stuff up here today because we're not going to share communion. Communion is usually our way of responding to what we've kind of read in the text. Today, we're going to respond a little differently in a way that's maybe a little more interactive and conversational. And so here's essentially a blank piece of paper, and I'm going to pass out a piece of paper about, I'll give you a couple of extras per row, but I'm thinking here, if you're with other family members, that you would do this together. You would do this as a family. So I'm not going to give one for every person, but it's essentially a blank piece of paper, as you'll see. And what I want to invite you to begin thinking about is, what is the taste of your place, the terroir of where you live? And on this blank piece of paper, I want to invite you to do a few things. Or let me give you some options. One option, and this might be really interesting, would be to draw a map of where you live. Who cares if it's to scale? Just map and sketch out where you live. And I would invite you to keep the kind of range of your map fairly small. So instead of drawing a 5-mile radius around your house, draw a 0.5-mile radius, draw a 1/4-mile radius. Maybe just cover your street or the immediately surrounding streets. Keep your focus pretty tight, because The reason why I'm suggesting this, and you don't have to do this, you can draw a 10-mile circle around your home, because yours and my ability to influence where we live, to change the taste of the place where we live, is most likely going to be around the immediate area that we actually reside. It's tough to influence something that's 5 miles away, a mile away, even a half a mile away. So consider maybe keeping it small. Maybe you want to draw a map. Maybe you want to draw a portrait of your street. Just some box houses. You know, they don't have to, whatever, or get as fancy as you want. What you would see if you were looking down your street. Maybe you want to draw that. And then I want to invite you to start labeling things as much as you can. Do you know the names of any people that live in these homes? Are there businesses nearby? Are there gathering spots for your neighborhood? Parks, libraries, etc. What makes up and label everything that you possibly can. And then color. So there are some crayons and markers in the back, and there will be some crayons and markers up here in the front. Like, consider for a moment, what color would you color your house? I don't mean like if you were repainting it. I mean, like, what color reflects your home? Might be a really weird and interesting question to ask yourself. What color reflects your street? Why? This is where kids might be really helpful. You know, they might be better at that sort of a question than we would. What places matter to you? What places don't you know about? Maybe you draw this map or this portrait and you realize that there's a few people, a few homes, a few neighbors you've never met, a few places you've never entered. You know, we've got like across the corner, the Four Brothers Fish and Chicken. Okay. Never been there. Can smell its grease often, you know. And people who have been there say it's like really good. Yeah, okay, you know. But people say it, right? Okay. So that would be like a place I've never been, and it is a gathering spot. That place is packed all the time. It's nuts. So, like, what are the places in your neighborhood that you don't know about? And then the final question would be, how can you contribute to the flavor of your place? Is there a step to take? Like, what could you do? Maybe, I don't know, I mean, you guys are smart people. You'll come up with something. Maybe you'll come up with a lot of things. But like, I'm wondering, do I need to go to the Four Brothers, you know, and kind of meet the owners and see what that place is like? Would it help me understand my neighborhood better? This question isn't so much, what can I contribute? Maybe it's the flip, like, how does my place need to flavor my life? Well, you could flip it around if you wanted to. You get the idea. There's no right or wrong way to do this. We're just going to take like 5 to 10 minutes. We'll see how it goes here. Plenty of time to have a conversation and to think, what is unique about where I live? What do I know about it? What don't I know about it? And what might God be asking me to do in response? All right? And if you're done early, find somebody around you maybe that's done early and have a conversation. Share what you've discovered or what stood out to you. Ready? Ready? Markers, crayons up here and in the back. Pipe cleaners if you need them. There's a few left that the kids haven't taken. All right, go.